All right, Allie Alvarigo and Dwayne Brummett here with another School Owner Talk. Allie, nice to be with you.
It's great to be with you as well, and I hear that you're sitting in your sunroom in outside your house is what, how many below 0 degrees?
Well, it's only 2 below, but wind chill, it's like, you know, about 16 or something. I don't know.
That's insane. I once experienced weather like that. I was doing a tactical firearms training seminar in the foothills of Colorado, and no joke, my nose was running, and it would run and freeze and fall as a chunk of frozen substance to the ground. That's how cold the wind. It was like 20 below zero wind chill. It was insanity.
Well, a little bit later today, what I'm going to do is I hear you can boil water and then throw it up in the air. Just make sure you're not downwind.
Right.
And it freezes in the air.
Wow, are you kidding me? That's crazy.
So when you get this, because I know this Arctic blast is going to come your way, so when you get this in a couple of days, you can try it.
Yeah, that is just insane. I'll do it with my daughter. We'll stand out on my deck and experiment.
Just make sure you're not downwind. That's the only thing.
Yeah, of course. That's what they say about Superman, right? When don't pee into the wind, don't spit on Superman's cape, something like that. Remember that song from years ago?
Yeah,
So what's our topic today, Dwayne? By the way, for the listeners that are listening, I was away this past weekend at the Atlantic City Hall of Fame. It's basically the Martial Art Magazine Hall of Honors run by Alan Goldberg, and it was just an amazing event. I was in a room of, you know, thousands of martial artists, and his event is taglined, it's not a martial art event, it's a event run by martial artists. I kind of like that. I like that all these people train and they're into the arts and they're into their training first, and they believe what I believe should be the case, that they're martial artists first and businessmen second. Not to say that one is more important than the other, but I find a lot of people, and I'm sure you do, that are businessmen and they're light on the martial art end, and that's sad to me. But anyway, I brought it up because so many people were coming up to me and saying, hey, I listen to your martial art talks on I get your list on Facebook, or I connected to it, and I love what you guys are doing. So that was really positive. So I'm glad that we're doing what we're doing, and hope the listeners out there pass us along and build up the listenership and help us out in that regard.
Yeah, and you know, this is going to dovetail right into our conversation today anyways, because the end game, or beginning with the game, or the end in mind, we've heard about that for years as martial arts school owners, and we all, I would say, what would you say, about 90-95% of us started our martial arts businesses because of the passion that we had for the martial arts, and we wanted to be able to share that with other people and hopefully make a living out of it if we could. And so that's going to be the conversation today is, you know, what do we need to do in order to, you know, take our passion? And I wanted to kind of share my story just a little bit with regards to, you know, how it happened for me. And then the epiphany that I had when I actually started to begin with the end in mind. So, with that being said, I'll just kind of give you a real quick backstory.
Let's do it. I
started in the martial arts when I was 17 years old. I was 1 month away from my 18th birthday, and I wanted to sign up. And it's funny because I had heard about the studio. I was out. It was August, and I was out lifeguarding. And these two little kids that looked like twins were playing, karate with each other in the pool. And so I blew my whistle at them. I said, hey, no karate in the pool. So they started swimming away, and so I blew my whistle at them again, and I said, hey, no swimming in the pool either. And they just kind of stopped and looked at me, and they're like, what are you talking about? So, you know, we had a little camaraderie there, and then at my break time, I had talked to them a little bit more, and they introduced me to their mom, and this nice little lady, I mean little, you know, lady was in karate too, and she's like, oh, yeah, you ought to come and check it out, and I'd always wanted to do it. In fact, when I was a kid, I always pretended like I knew what I was doing, but I didn't. And so I fixed it until I made it, right? And so what I did was I went ahead and checked it out that night, and I was hooked. Well, I went and told my mom about it, and she was like, well, I'm not going to sign you up for it because you never follow through with anything. And so I convinced the owner, which, by the way, I would recommend not anybody doing. I convinced him to let me sign myself up even though I was a month away from my 18th birthday. So as an aside note, as a business owner now, I would never allow anybody to do that, but that's what happened. Fast forward years later, I end up having business partners to open up our current TriStar Martial Arts Academy. And just the passion that I had that I wanted to be a teacher. That's all I did. And I wanted to help change lives with the martial arts that had changed my life. And so we all put in $500 to start the studio, and I didn't have $500, so I used my credit card and bought $500 worth of equipment for the studio. And we started in the basement of this church, and we were there for a couple of months, and then we went to a grade school where one of the partners in our business was actually a secretary there, so we were able to rent out the grade school just on Tuesdays and Thursdays when we needed it. I think it was like maybe $10 or $15 an hour, whatever it was, until we built up enough clientele to open up a storefront. All that going on during that time, I'm working in the Kmart Corporation as a meat cutter, and I worked my way up into management. I was an assistant meat manager at that time, and then I decided, this is what I wanted to do full time. I want to, not cut meat for the rest of my life, and I want to teach martial arts. And so I pulled back from the meat cutting, dropped my assistant management position. And so then rather than 40 hours a week, I dropped to 32 so I could still keep my health insurance, and that allowed me at least 8 more hours at the studio, and eventually trading that out and buying my partners out and then owning the business solely. That's where I came from. By the time I bought the studio out, I had about 190 students that were paying students, I had a dream, that I wanted to move forward and build this empire. And part of the empire was, just like everybody else, when you go to these events, talking to other martial artists, you want a lot, everybody's saying how many students they have. And so I only had about 190, 200 students. And, I kept my mouth shut when everybody was saying, yeah, I have 350, I have 400 students. And I don't know, Allie, if you went through this when you were growing your businesses, but, there's an ego thing that comes along with, you can strut. Did you get that, or were you ever in that situation?
Yeah, but first of all, I it's interesting because I hear your story, and it's very similar to many other martial artists, coming from, working at another job, eventually getting to the school and opening it, and then eventually, quitting their full-time job. However, the different scenario in most other stories is that they don't build their school to the 190 students before they do it, or they don't build their school after they quit and go full-time, because I find that to be it takes extreme discipline to be self-employed and drive yourself every day and make sure that you're doing what is necessary to get the job done and to grow your school and become profitable. Now, to answer your question, though, about me, whenever I meet people, I would, especially at a martial art business convention, let's say, I introduce myself to somebody. I go, hey, how's your dojo doing? And they're like 300 students. They don't even want to, yeah, it's doing good. And my friend and I, who John Oschlager, I mentioned him a few times on other calls. He runs Nakato School of Self-Defense. He kind of gets a little offended. He's like, you should say, my school's doing great. The students are progressing. I have tons of black belts. I'm changing people's lives. It's not about the student count. And quite often the student count is, as you know, there's a saying in the martial arts, and you want to make a liar out of a martial artist, ask them how many students they have, because we all talk about the highest number that we've ever had. Some of them aren't even actively training. And when I kind of dialed down with a lot of my prospective coaching clients, and I finally, ask them how many they have. Well, we have 90 or 100 students. Okay, and when I really look at the books, there's more like 20, 25, 30 paying. So it's usually a third of what people tell you. That's kind of the way the nature of the business is. So, I get that all the time, Dwayne. I hear people telling me all the time how great their school is doing, and I don't know if that's the honest truth. Did that answer that question?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I was so green when I would start going to some of these conventions and everybody's talking about how many students they had. So in my head, I was thinking, in order to be successful, I got to have 300 students. And the most amount of students that I ever had that I know of, because prior to actually, keeping track of them, maybe I had more at one time. If so, it wasn't that much more. But I had 341 students. And right. I was working my tail off, and I was barely making anything. compared to what I make now.
Right.
Part of the reason why was because of the amount of money that I was charging per month. So
right.
one of the first epiphanies that I had, and it wasn't because of me, it was because of the industry that educated me, that, you know, it wasn't about the number of students that I had with regards to, you know, having a profitable business, but it was the, you know, it was the amount of money that I was able to charge per month.
Right.
And then all the other things too, because I wasn't doing special events or anything like that. So one of the biggest things was for me was to go, oh, I don't have to have 350 students to
right.
make, you know, 30,000 or 25,000 or even 20,000 a month. You know, all I need is, you know, this amount of students paying me this much money per month, and then I can make it. So that was one of the biggest mind shift things for me. And then
right.
the other thing was that, you know, having 341 students, I was crazy, and there were so many things that were missing in systems and management and those type of things. So dialing it down, you know, and at that time I made a decision that I only wanted 200 students.
Right.
I wanted to drop 141 students. So, like, I did no marketing. I did nothing. you know, it took us a while. It took us, I don't remember how long it took us, I mean, 3 or 4 years to start to drop. We never have gotten to 200. But I've raised my prices, too, so that's helped. And so I've traded out $90 people for $169 people, which has been, you know, great. So in that shift, that was one of the things that made a difference to me, was I didn't have to shoot for what everybody else was
right.
shooting for, at least what they said they were shooting for, having 300 or 400 students or what have you. And then the other thing was really understanding that I want to have a clear picture of what I want my business to look like when I sell it.
Right.
And that took me a long time to understand, because when somebody asked me that, I said, well, you know, in my head, I'm thinking, well, I don't want to sell it. Why do I want to sell it?
Right.
And what they were trying to teach me was that, you know, until you decide what you want it to look like and what the profit needs to be and how the systems need to run, by the time that you sell it, you're never going to get to that position anyways.
Right.
And that was huge when it finally clicked that I needed to understand what I wanted my business to look like, where I wanted the profits to be, in order to be able to sell it in the end. And now I have staff and instructors that, you know, eventually maybe I would sell it to them, you know, maybe when I'm 65, 70 years old, I want to, you know, whatever, but, I eventually do probably want to sell it to them, but it won't be worth anything to them if there isn't a policy and procedures manual, you know, if there isn't staff training that is, you know, etched in stone, if you will, if there isn't the clerical staff training that isn't etched in stone, if there isn't a curriculum, and even more than a curriculum, if there isn't lesson plans. And so I went as far as to create in the three areas of our business, at least the way that I look at it, we have three areas. We have the instructional, you know, with the teachers. We have the clerical, so what's happening for the program director and anybody that supports him or her. And then you have the marketing. So I wanted to have systems in place for all three of those areas. And, of course, those areas can be broken down, and we could spend tons of time on many calls to break those areas down. But what I decided first and foremost, and I spoke about this last week, was I want to take care of the instructional, because when I get the instructional part done, you know, or at least 80% to where I want it to be, then I can start freeing myself up to be able to work on the marketing and also the program director spot as well. So that's the first thing that I personally focused in on, was I wanted to have a defined curriculum all the way up to black belt. Second
right.
thing is I wanted to have lesson plans so mm-hmm. that we test everybody every quarter, and I know there's some schools that test every month. Everybody's on a 3-month cycle, but everybody's on a different cycle. I have the whole school on the same cycle. That's just
right.
That's how it works. And so I have lesson plans that are written, and I've got 24 lesson plans, and the way that the lesson plan is written, I can pull things out that, you know, some of the things don't necessarily need two classes to teach, but I do, you know, allow them. But if I have a shorter, like this, this curriculum cycle, December through February, is a curriculum cycle for us. And
right.
So this curriculum cycle is actually shorter because I take 2 weeks off for Christmas and New Year's. So it actually is, I think, two classes short. So I actually pulled two classes out of the lesson plan. But that was the first thing that I focused in on. And I wanted it to be, like I said, 80% to perfect.
Right.
So I didn't spend a lot of time on it, and I've revised it as time has gone on. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. Let me chime in just to summarize, because I want to point out a few bullet points of what you're saying so that the listeners could hear it. Now, by the way, there's a great book, and I'm sure that you read it, and it kind of is one that you've loved. It's called The E-Myth by Michael Gerber.
Yes.
And then there's The E-Myth Revisited, and basically in that book, it talks about what Dwayne did. He basically is thinking with the end in mind. Michael Gerber calls it the crap-out date, like when you're going to sell your company, when you're going to get rid of it. And there's some key factors that you're talking about that I want to point out is that, one, you have to have something that's sellable. In other words, Michael Gerber talks about it. There was a lady, there's a story in the book about a lady who made pies, and she made amazing pies. And it's so interesting because they just had a Shark Tank episode where they went back and showed about a lady who's making pies, and she made these, or actually cakes, and the sharks bought into it. Barbara Corcoran bought into it, and it was where they launched it. They made tons of money. They moved to a bigger location. Their quality dropped a little. They couldn't fulfill, and many, many customers got angry, and their business dropped back. So normally a business could fail at that point, but Barbara Corcoran and the owner of this company went back, and they moved the company back to a small town where they started, and started it as a grassroots, knowing how to replicate the pies, making more and scale them up without losing the quality and losing, what you had, what was the unique USP, the unique selling proposition. So what you're saying, Dwayne, and for the listeners, is that we have to build a company with systems. And Dwayne named the three top areas. And of course, all those areas could be broken down in probably hundreds of different tasks or goals. But most importantly, though, it's important for us to know that we have to have things in place so that if we do get sick, our school can run on its own. If we decide to go to Florida and live 6 months out of the year or 4 months out of the year or do whatever or pass it on to somebody, it has to be something that they could buy. And by the way, one thing I want to point out is most schools are personality driven, meaning that the instructor is why people are there. And I just had this happen with one of my clients who got in a car accident. He couldn't teach classes for about 6 months, and his school dropped. It literally split in half, and he lost half of his enrollment. So that's because it was personality driven. What Dwayne is talking about as far as systems is a curriculum and processes and systems that are driven by the personality. Now, let me be clear on that. Personality driven is when the personality drives the car. But a curriculum driven by personality is when you drive the car and Ferrari built the car. And you're driving the Ferrari, but you have all the engineering that Ferrari built, and you get to experience what he did as well, but it's him, it's his name, and that's what we have to do. We have to kind of extricate ourselves from the situation so that we build these systems. And now, Dwayne, like you said, I'm sorry, I'm kind of just summarizing it all and talking a little, is that now, Dwayne, you could step back and you could let your company build itself. In fact, it might even grow without you being there as much. And how beautiful is that when that happens, when you come into work after taking a few days off and you see that people signed up, money was made, people are happy, promotions are being done. To me, that's just incredible.
Yeah, and it sure does give you a lot of freedom. One of my goals this year is I want to take a full month off, not walking into the studio for 1 month. And part of the reason I want to do that is because I want to see that what I've created can sustain itself. But then the other thing is it's a fear of mine not to be there. And I want to help myself overcome that fear. And it's not that I micromanage, because believe me, I do not micromanage. I will micromanage if I step out of my office. So, for instance, what I mean is if I step out of my office and I see, instructors interacting on the floor, it's really hard for me not to get out there and do it.
Right.
And so I will purposely not pay attention to the floor unless it's review time where I am, watching the floor and reviewing my instructors and those type of things. That's different.
Right.
But then I have a different focus at that time. But it's really hard for me not to jump in and do that. Even at the front desk with my program director, I will step out of the office and I'll see a need and I'll go and fill it. And I don't necessarily micromanage that, because that part I actually don't really care for, the clerical part.
Right.
So, I don't really have a big problem micromanaging that, but I do. I want to take off a whole month just because I want to see what will happen. And, you know, worst case scenario, you lose a few students. But I don't foresee that happening. But
right.
it's important for us owners to get that whole end game in mind, just so that we can start to build the business of our dreams. And what I've found is that you can do it and not lower your core standards with regards to you know, the martial arts, like the physical martial arts, for your students. You don't have to lower the standards with that. You build that in to your curriculum, your lesson plans, and then also your instructional lesson plans when you're teaching your instructors on what to expect and where the students need to be. And does that all make sense, Allie?
Oh, it's absolutely. I mean, for me, obviously, it makes total sense. But for the listeners, I want them to really understand what you're saying. But, you know, you don't have to what you're saying. And I'll just clarify, for those of you out there that are looking to make this jump, you need to understand that just because you're not a part of the everyday scenario, that doesn't mean that the quality is going to go away, and that you're going to give an inferior or a lesser quality product to your clientele. As long as you focus on the business and the system so that there's a fail-safe. For example, for lack of better examples, McDonald's. I'm a vegan, so I'm not very much into the whole entire thing. I just wanted to be clear on that one. But at McDonald's, you go and buy a hamburger in New York, France, Italy, Japan, they're all identical. You can trust that hamburger is going to be exactly the same. Not to say that the quality is amazing, but the standards of the mediocre quality is going to be unbelievable, right? So when you think about the quality of the burger, it's the same across the board, no matter what country you're in. The same way the pickle goes on and the ketchup and the cheese and the way it's cooked at the same temperature and the product and the paper. It might be written in French, but it's identical. So, and by the way, it's interesting. I was just in England a few months back, and they had a McDonald's, but it was totally, the decor was totally green. I mean, when I say that, it was actually done in green because they were a green McDonald's, meaning that they didn't waste a lot of paper. They used recycled products. So in that particular town in England, it was a very kind of posh kind of town. McDonald's found a way to make their stinking hamburgers relevant to what was going on, right? So you need to have those systems in place, like Dwayne is saying. So everyone who's listening, you don't have to sacrifice. You don't have to lose quality. You don't have to do any of that stuff. You just got to concentrate more on running your business. Focus on running the business, not working in the business. So
I was just going to add to that is that, you know, your quality check for your students is every 3 months. I mean, you can see how your instructors are teaching every 3 months when you sit and you watch your student test.
Right.
So if you're looking for some type of quality control, you know, that's it right there. Every 3 months you have quality control, whether you're testing monthly, and meaning that, you know, a third of your population is testing this month and a third is testing next month and a third is testing, you know, 2 months from now. Or like me, where, you know, every 3 months, every February, May, August, and November, I have a testing cycle. So I can every 3 months test my own instructors and make sure that what they're teaching is the quality that I'm looking for. Obviously, you have some students that are going to be better than others. That's in every scenario. But you look at it overall, and you can tell, you know, whether your instructors are teaching it correctly or not, or to the quality that you want, based upon how your students are performing on the test. I would agree, and I'm glad that you brought up the book about Michael Gerber's book, because that I read that book, and it's probably one of the books that helped me decide that I wanted to make that change in you know, in my own business. And that's one of the reasons I bought my partners out, was because, you know, I really wanted to turn this into a business. They wanted to keep it more of a mom and pop type thing, And I mean, no offense to a mom and pop type thing, but I needed a business to support my my lifestyle or my livelihood, because I didn't want to keep cutting meat for the rest of my life. I wanted to be able to you know, have this as my core business, and so I needed to rearrange things and make it a viable business. But as a school owner, it's really important for us to, you know, we teach this when we're looking for our black belts, right? We know that we want our black belts to have this many hand techniques, this many foot techniques, these many self-defense scenarios, this many one steps, or these many forms, or what have you. And we expect them to be to this caliber or X caliber. And so we need to do the same thing with our business, is where should my business be in, you know, this amount of time when I go to sell it? And then you start working backwards. How am I going to get there? It's the same way that you developed your black belts.
Yeah, and you know what, too? By the way, I you know, of course, I hear a lot of really gems in what you're saying. And one other thing, too, I want to point out, you basically, and again, I'll clarify, but you basically run your business like a mom-and-pop business. I run mine the same way, but not the way most people think. Like, my vision of a mom-and-pop business is very hands-on. You know, it's the mom-and-pop bringing you the soup at the restaurant, and they're the ones making sure that they check on you and come out. Well, you can have that same environment and that same quality control and that same customer care and the same feel without actually doing it yourself. It's all about training. So I think a lot of people equate mom-and-pop businesses with that down-home quality, you know, high-level customer satisfaction. And it's not necessarily always true, because there are certain business owners that couldn't run a quality business if they were doing everything themselves. They still would be terrible at it. But so for the listeners out there, again, expanding to a bigger type of business or bigger student growth or a higher income bracket or whatever we want to call it, you could still have that incredible superior quality. And that's important. And by the way, there are some systems to make sure that that always happens and that you stay on top of those things. But yeah, I just wanted to make sure everyone knew that. I don't want you to think like, you know, when we grew, we forgot about the little guys, so to speak. You know, that's not at all our goal. Our goal is to help you grow and still keep that family, still keep that environment where people just love to be with you and feel like they're part of your intimate family. Make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I equate that to a little restaurant here in town that's been here for years. I grew up going there, and we would go there and eat breakfast every once in a while. And it's called Blue's Cafe, and the owners have owned it for years. I can't even tell how many years. I forget. But the funny thing is that I always go there for their biscuits and gravy. I love their biscuits and gravy. And the thing that has happened is two of the same waitresses that were there when I was that were waitressing when I was young are still there now. And when I had my son, I decided that, you know, once a week I wanted to bring him in there and give him the same heritage, if you will. I know it sounds goofy, that I had when and the same feelings that I would have when I go there. And so I'd go there, and he started growing up there. Eventually he, you know, they have a not popsicles, but they have the suckers at the counter for the kids, and right. He'd always want a sucker, and so I would tell him, you know, hey, if you want a sucker, then you got to go pay the bill.
Right.
And so I'd give him the money, and he'd walk up there, and he'd have to interact. He learned how to talk to adults. Not that I didn't teach him that, but I mean, I this was one of the ways that I wanted to reinforce that he had to know how to. That's one of the ways he had to learn how to count money.
Right.
Like, you know, as he got older, but the whole interaction. We walk in there. They know my name, not because I'm famous, but just because I go there all the time, but they remember my name. They know my son's name. They know my mom's name. You know, they'll ask, what was it, probably a couple of months ago, one of the ladies asked me, she goes, oh, so is your mom in Texas yet? Because she knows my mom's snowboots. And so I said, yeah, she's in Texas. You know,
yeah.
Oh, well, tell her, when's the next time you're going to talk to her? And I said, well, I'm going to talk to her. Well, tell her that my sister, da-da-da-da, whatever. And so I relayed the message. And
right.
And and they expanded, too. I mean, their business is bigger now than it was when I was a kid. But they never, ever lost that feeling.
Right.
And whenever you walk through the door, everybody knows your name. Unless they have a brand new waitress, everybody knows your name. And that's
right.
what you can have inside of your business.
It's almost like that old TV show Cheers, right, where everyone knows your name, you know, that old bar, with, and everyone would walk in and they'd yell out your name. You know, and that's incredible. I mean, and by the way, for those that are listening, that's nothing more than proper training to teach your staff to be able to look people in the eyes, memorize names, develop rapport. I have a program manager now that he literally, if he wanted to, he could sit behind the desk with his feet up, and he has like a harem of my student moms that will do all his work for him. He wants to stuff envelopes. He's like, okay, you're going to stuff the envelopes. You're going to stamp the envelopes. And I walk in quite often. He's got a conveyor line of people doing work for him, and they just love him. And he sits and he chats and he makes jokes. They bring him freshly baked cookies and desserts. And I mean, it's just insane. So that's when you train your staff to have that kind of environment that they create, and they kind of perpetuate that feeling within the school. You know, you're doing something right. And that's the key, is to really create the end game, which you said you started, you know, we talked about that, having the end in mind. Like, what do we want our school to be like? And I just did a seminar this weekend where I asked people, what is their brand? And people would say things to me like, I teach Wing Chun, that's my brand. I teach Ishinru, that's my brand. Well, honestly, it's not. Your brand is what you are, meaning like the cleanest school in town, the friendliest family-based business in town, a place where educates children on life skills, teaches them martial arts. But your brand is who you are, what your product gives. Like, you know, a perfect example could be like Coca-Cola. What's their brand? It's not their logo. We know that. It's recognizable. But what are they known for? They're known for Coca-Cola, for the soda, for sweets and blah, 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 right? Like Nike. Nike is known for their athletic equipment and their shoes and their sneaker. You know, so that, what do? They train, they have runners running in their equipment because it's such a quality. And I invite you as school owners to listen to this and jot down 10 things about who you are. Try to write a little summary of what business you are, what type of company you are, what makes you different than all the other schools that are out there. Why would someone want to come to you? And I did this with the people in the room. I said, everyone yell out what you do. And they yelled out things like, we're a family school. So I'd write it down on the whiteboard and, you know, in marker. You know, we teach self-defense. We're a family-based business. Anyway, long story short, there's like 10 things. And a lot of people were saying, oh, I was just going to say that. And I was going to say that. And then I said to them, that was really where the epiphany was. I did this drill with my staff once, and I was really proud that everyone yelled out all different things and had a lot to say. And then a few days later, I had this big, huge sticky note on my wall with all the things they had to say, and a light went off in my head. And I said, you know what? I would guarantee you, and by the way, it was proof at this seminar, everyone thinks the same thing about what they do. And it's all similar. We teach confidence. We teach self-esteem. We teach focus. We teach blah, 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 blah. And everyone thinks they do that. So every school thinks, you know, or the people who see us think we do all the same crud. So now what makes you unique? What makes your school stand out? What is your brand? You know, Long Island Ninjutsu Centers is my school, where it's not just kicking and punching. It's the martial arts and beyond. People actually believe, and they know that. They believe in what we do because we don't just teach ninjutsu. We teach life skills. I mean, I have guys that are Black Hawk helicopter pilots, Navy SEALs, you know, professional bodyguards, you know, Secret Service, moms and dads, you know. You know, it's, the list goes on, and district attorney, and they all say that the martial arts helped shape and change their lives. So what is it that we do? What's the end game? What do people know about us? Who are we? Are we a superhero with a secret identity? If we are, we got to change that. That makes sense?
Yeah. It certainly does. It most certainly makes sense. And I love the action plan here, because otherwise this is just a, you know, hopefully a good audio program for somebody to listen to, but without the action that you said, take 10 things, write it down. You know, I think about, what is it that when I leave, what is it that I want people to say about me? What is it that I want them to say about what the studio has done for them? And then how do you work that into your systems so that the school is actually doing it, and you yourself don't always have to be the one to do it. And I know that when I started to do that, one of the biggest fears that even my wife had was, you know, aren't you afraid that you're going to lose students because you're not the one that's doing this all the time? And I said, no. I said, number one is I can't keep this up. I just can't do it. Number two is that I want to give my instructors the privilege and the feeling that they're going to get of accomplishment, of knowing that they actually help somebody overcome these obstacles or achieve these things. And, you know, it used to be where I would get all the Christmas presents every single year. And again, we're off for 2 weeks. So I'm telling you what, almost for 2 weeks straight, I'd have a coupon, or it's not a coupon, but a gift card to different restaurants. And almost for the 2 weeks straight, I could go eat for free, you know,
right.
every day.
Right.
And when I started implementing these things and having a staff and letting them do do all that and get that experience, they started getting Christmas gifts. And I remember the first year that started happening, my wife would say, you know, don't you, you know, feel bad at all? And I said, no. I said, I mean, yeah, I wish that I would get something, but it's not about me. It's about the school. And, you know, I'm happy that my instructors are now getting something, because that means they're doing the right thing.
What's really cool is that, you know, and I did the same thing where I went out and I talked to the kids and I'm like, you know, going to make sure you take care of Sensei Renshi Ryan and Sensei Peter and the instructors and show them thanks. You're teaching them a very valuable lesson by doing that. And, again, it's important. Sometimes people think like, hey, maybe you're begging or you're asking for things. I don't want anything for myself. I have everything that I ever wanted. And if I don't have it, I could buy it because I make enough money to do so. So I would rather that they will then show that respect. And, you know, I have to tell you, I see the pride in my junior instructors and chief instructors' eyes when they told me, like, I got over $450 in Christmas gifts, you know, in cash and gift certificates to Best Buy and this place and that place. I'm like, well, you deserve it, man. I'm happy that that happened. You know, this is important. You know, so again, it's one of those things where we need to, you know, we need to instill. And by the way, there's kind of a system for that, because we want to teach that as a lesson, altruism, and showing what we call in the Japanese martial arts, giri, you know, loyalty and dedication and honor and all of that towards your instructors, because they've given you things that will change your life forever. You know, so
yeah.
Yeah, so anyway, I think we have to probably do another call, Duane, on this topic, because we're kind of running out of time, but there's so much more to continue this on. So why don't we call this, you know, volume one, and let's have a two-parter on this.
That sounds great. Yeah. So
I really think that it's, you know, we wanted to try to keep the calls to a minimum and not go overboard, but you and I could talk forever. We could do another 3 hours with nonstop on this, but I want the listeners to maybe take those action steps, write them down, find out what their unique selling proposition is, not just so much like I teach ninjutsu, although for me, I have to tell you, that is my unique selling proposition, because I'm the only guy, I am the only guy that does this, and I do it well, and I market it well, but I don't market ninjutsu. I'm not running around with a hood in the middle of the night with smoke bombs and jumping backwards into trees. Most of my people, their ears go up when they hear ninjutsu, and then I sell them on what I believe the art to be, the spiritual side and the compassion and the empathy and all that stuff, and how we teach listening skills and focus to not only kids but adults as well. And you know, I have many other selling propositions. We're the cleanest, we're the largest, we're the, you know, we're the most professional at what we do. We have, you know, licensed instructors that have gone through stringent training programs under my watch. I mean, we've been changing people's lives for over 23 years in my community. I mean, that's a pretty powerful selling statement when people come in and they want to be a part of what we do. And that's why my school flourishes without any kind of gimmicks and games and advertising schemes, as they call them in the UK. But anyway, so yeah, so that's where it's at. And I know you have that as well with your school.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we can talk a little bit about that on the next call. So begin with the end in mind, or you know, get those action steps, write them down, and we're going to share a little bit more on our second call. So, Allie, I appreciate your time, and everybody have a great day.
Yeah, Duane, thanks so much, man. You're awesome. I love listening to you, and again, you inspire me. You really do, and I listen to you talk, and then it reminds me of what I need to do, and you know, get me, you know, things that I've done or forgotten to do or never did. So thank you for being you and helping me out as well.
Oh, my pleasure. I pick up so much more from you. So thanks. Everybody have a great day.
Yeah, take care. Talk to you soon.